Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Home in on end-of-season savings on bedding, curtains, wallpapers and more. In-store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock today, standing in for Joe this week. I want to go straight away now over to Joanne. Joanne, good afternoon.
Hello, Katie. How are you?
Joanne, you were looking, as many of us were, at those photographs that were released yesterday of the new junior minister lineup.
That's correct.
And what were you thinking?
It's dismay, to be honest with you, Katie, and it's double dismay for me here. I'm a Louth woman, so I'm here in Louth, and I'm a woman, and neither of those factors were represented in any, you know, to any satisfaction.
Okay, so you lost lost both the gender and the geography.
Yeah. I'm a loser on two counts.
I suppose we just, in case people aren't tuned into this, we better explain to them. So there was 23 junior ministers announced yesterday, and we were told, well, let's go back a few days when the cabinet was announced last week, and there was only three of the 15 there that were female. We were told, well, don't worry about it because the junior ministers are coming up and we'll sort out the whole gender balance issue at that point. And out of the 23, there are just six women.
So, I mean, in the bigger picture, it's a really, really poor representation, a really poor show, to be honest with you. And I would have thought that two really well experienced leaders would have known better, because this is not just a simple snapshot, a nice picture, a nice photograph. It's a really poor oversight, having overlooked a really important demographic here in terms of, you know, we become what we see. And there just aren't enough women represented there. And people say, oh, it's not enough women in politics, there's not enough representation, it's hard for women. Well, of course it's hard for women, because we're on the back foot before we even get going.
Now, I'm just going to put to you a few of the things that they would put to you in terms of there were the most women. Obviously, this was the first general election that we had the gender quota of 40%. So basically, if parties didn't have 40% representation in their candidate slate, they wouldn't qualify for funding. So they didn't have to have them, but, you know, there was a very strong incentive there. So they did, generally, all the parties went out, they managed to find enough women to make up that 40% figure. And that's what they'll say. We put them out there and the electorate didn't vote for them. So what can we do?
Well, I'm going to challenge that, Katie, because here in County Louth, this is a five-seater constituency. And in the previous general election, there was one woman elected out of those five. And in 2024, three women were elected out of this five-seater constituency. OK, so if Louth could do gender balance, wow, we'd be knocking it out of the park. All right. So we've got three women who were elected. Now, Joanna Byrne has been put on the front bench of Sinn Féin. That's fine. But it's not a seat in that picture, and it's not a seat at the cabinet table for County Louth as a woman, as female politicians.
The issue, of course, is that even though there was a very significant jump in the number of women that were put forward for election in the last election, a lot of them were added very close to the election day. So they didn't have a chance, and they were up against, you know, there was the obvious constituency leaders in their parties. So they were kind of used as sweepers, I think, and also I think, and this is not in every case, and it's a generalisation to say that there are obviously some very strong women added in some tickets late in the day. But I think the difficulty was they were not, the groundwork wasn't done in time, basically, to ensure that the female candidates that were put forward had the same go at it as the men.
Yeah, and there's far too many examples to really be able to deny that. I mean, there's a lot of gender showboating going on, and it just, when it came down to giving the big jobs and the big responsibilities, they didn't deliver on the gender balance.
What difference does it make, Joanne?
It makes a huge difference. It makes a huge difference, particularly for younger women, that they're being, we're being who's your leader? Your leaders are predominantly men. We're not getting the female voice out. We're not getting the female leadership. We're not getting female representation because you vote as you see and you vote as you do. And I'm not saying this is in a way to do down how, you know, men or males make decisions and how they represent, because that would be an injustice to men and male representatives. But we need a greater balance. And I believe, I'm no expert on it, but I do believe that we seem to be well behind in international standards in the number of women demographically or proportionately that are at the main table making decisions, making policy and planning our futures.
Well, I don't have that stat, but I do have a stat for where we are just in terms of our political representation generally. The last Dáil had 37 women out of the entire Dáil. It was 158 in that Dáil. That was 23%. This Dáil, 25%. So we've managed to edge forward by 2% in terms of our the number of TDs we have in the Dáil that are women. But that puts us at something like 100 or 104th place.
104th place, yeah.
It's just so poor
in
any context.
And we had really strong women in the last cabinet, and you would have hoped that there would be a build on that. And I feel like it's a backward move. It's a backward step.
Okay, look, there's a message in here, actually. I'm going to just read it out to you and put it to you.
Mm-hmm.
This is from, I'm told, a female listener. They say, every female politician in Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael with any Dáil experience has been given a position as a junior or a senior minister. Every other woman in either party elected to the Dáil is there for the first time. It would be unfair to parachute them into ministerial positions just for optics. What do you say to that?
Okay, well, I don't think, somebody can correct me on this, but I don't think that any woman of the women who were elected in the 2024 general election got those votes as a result of optics. They got the votes because they proved their worth and they proved their position. When I look at the two women who were elected in this five-seater constituency, you had Paula Butterley, an experienced, a woman, a 20-year experience as a barrister, highly educated, very capable, very articulate, very active. She's been a local councillor for years before she went for the general election. Erin McGreehan for Fianna Fáil, she has been a senator for the previous 4 years. So she's a career politician who's very adept at navigating around the legislation and around the decision makers and lobbying for what's important for her constituency. So there's two women. They weren't coming into this green. They didn't get all of those votes just for optics.
Yeah.
Now, and you know, and I mean, everybody will say that every candidate is entitled, but you know, for our two leaders, the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael leaders, there's got to be. It's so nuanced and it's so multi-layered, the decisions of how to choose ministers. But where's this layer? Where is the layer of showing women representing people in this country?
Do you think that the government policy would look different and sound different and be different if there was more women at, you know, the cabinet table and in the junior ministerial ranks? Do you think women would do politics differently?
I do believe that. I believe, for example, if you look at two women who kind of stand out in my mind from the last government, there was Helen McEntee. So as a very simple example, she brought in legislation in relation to, I don't know what it's technically called, I can't recall, but in relation to in relation to abuse and within relationships,
did,
in relation to stalking
she
legislation.
She did a lot of gender, yeah, it's a lot
she
of,
did a lot of that.
So, issues around gender-based violence, domestic abuse, and she brought in that legislation around stalking.
Yes, so a very much pro-woman legislation which was brought in, and she's to be thanked and admired for that. Heather Humphreys, her department, very much a strong female voice supporting family, because remember, it's family as well. And as I say, and not to say that men don't represent family, don't get me wrong, but there's two women who really stood out as strong politicians and who led a very strong representing agenda during their time.
I'm hearing names here like Noel Brown, the mother and baby scheme. There's been male politicians who have taken very strong positions and moved policy forward with women in mind as well.
Simon
we
Harris.
Have to acknowledge, yeah.
Indeed, and Simon Harris, in his role in Department of Health, in the, I think, the 221 Plus group, he advocated for women very strongly, and that's an important example. So this isn't about us or them or us, A or B, you know, but there is a piece missing. There is definitely a piece missing in this. And then if I talk further to talk about geographically and how disappointing it is, as I say, double dismay, and here I'm in Dundalk, geographically we've also missed out.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, well, that's what they'll say, is that they had to balance geography and gender, and I suppose, you know, there is, and this is in, I'm just saying, this is in the context of the most junior ministers in the history of the state, three more than we had the last time. They were saying we can't surely have this many junior ministers, which was when we were at the 20 mark. We're now up at 23 and apparently no stop to it. And we still can't spread them out gender-wise and geography-wise enough. Yeah.
And I mean, Katie, every constituency, in every constituency, they're going to say that theirs is the most important. But here I'm in Dundalk, and this is, what is it? It's the second most densely populated outside Dublin. It's a five-seater constituency. And with the exception of a brief position which Fergus O'Dowd had in the cabinet in recent years, but with the exception of that, we haven't had a minister or a representative at the cabinet table for 18 years.
I remember being down in Waterford some years ago and similar complaints about how the South East was very badly represented at Cabinet as well over the years, and the difficulties that left behind for that part of the country. Can I go back to the gender thing, though? Because
sure.
I'm trying to get to the bottom. Like, do you think that you need to be a woman to really understand what the policies that impact on women are? You know, is that too simplistic?
I don't think that, again, this is not every man, but I don't think that all men, that a lot of men don't put themselves, don't see the perspective that you go into a room and you're the only woman, or that you're the only female voice, and you're being guided and being led by nobody else who looks like you, sounds like you, has your experience or perspective. And that's a fact.
Why, and then go back to the very, very basic thing. There were all those women, hundreds and hundreds of women out there banging on doors looking for our votes. Why don't more women vote for women?
And over in the States, that's a huge question. Mm-hmm. But here in Ireland, I don't know why that is. Is it a culture thing that we've just become, are we conditioned, are we too used to just acknowledging the man at the top of the room? And again, I don't say this as anti-man, because we've had really strong female leaders. We've had two female presidents gone back years. So, you know, we're not alien to a woman being at the top of the room. Ironically, you know, when you go through school in Ireland, most national school teachers are women. So we're well used to, you know, women being in charge, but it's just not getting through on the political side. And that's a problem for legislation. That's a problem for young women coming up. We can see, for example, earlier this year, the Young Scientists Exhibition, more and more young women coming into STEM. But where are they in politics? And I believe that it needs to be at a grassroots level. We're not obviously getting the message across, and perhaps not supporting women enough. You know, Holly Cairns, she's a young woman, young female politician. She's a great example. We need to see more examples.
Well, and I heard Holly out in the last number of years, and other female politicians going public about the amount of abuse, and saying that this is a serious issue for women who put themselves forward for public life, that the kind of abuse that they will get online, I'm talking about in particular, is very gendered, it's quite different and on a different scale to what a young man would get if they were going forward for local election or national politics.
It's true. And it was really only, I think, towards the end of the last government that we really started to see action coming in to protect all gender of politician who are experiencing any kind of abuse or toxic responses or communication. But it's the childcare matter, but it's you do as you see. And I'm just dismayed because we ended out in the last government, I think, on a strong footing and a strong representation for women, and it's just gone backwards. And as somebody said, it's like a picture from the from the 60s or something. Oh,
well, obviously, it was Jed Nash saying it's 2025, not 1955. But again, if you go back to 1955 and think about the roles that men and women had back then, the Dáil was an institution that was set up and is run for men with wives. There's no two ways about that. The sitting times, the late sittings, it's set up for people who do not have childcare issues to be thinking about. That hasn't changed much in all the years that I have. I've spent many years working in Leinster House. It hasn't changed much, and people have been complaining about it. The women who have managed to break through have complained about it for years and years. And somehow we haven't worked out how that can be changed to facilitate people who do have, care responsibilities as well. Which, and I know a lot of the men have children as well, but nobody ever asks them, how do they do it? How do they manage it? Because actually, they generally have other people managing it.
No, and hopefully, that is a challenge for male parents as well. But you remember in the days when, we had COVID and then there was all the remote working and everything, and people were able to, we somehow became more flexible about how we lived. And I just feel in the government side, it's all shrunk back to what it was, and that flexibility is gone. And even if there were flexibility, that might make it easier for women to work as full-time politicians because they're not constantly having to be at the mothership, ironically, in Leinster House.
Why, like when you say that you think you feel like it's just going backwards, why do you think that is? Like how did we get to a position where we actually finally, after years talking about it, have the gender quotas in place? When it comes down to it, we see the line up there in front of our eyes of cabinet and the junior ministers.
Well, and these decisions come from the top. So, you know what I mean? There's also a whole crop of younger politicians that were elected this time, but they're not the key decision makers. The decisions are coming from elsewhere. And, Simon Harris, for example, he's a young politician. Micheál Martin would appear to be, a widely minded politician in terms of ages. But I was reading research, it's coming out, it always does in January time, about new trends and so on. And there's a lot of talk about Gen Z and how they think differently and how they function entirely differently to previous generations. And perhaps the key to change will come in this generation of people in their 20s now, because it's certainly not apparent here in January with a new cabinet being elected, being chosen.
You wouldn't think of going into politics yourself, Joanne.
I'd be way down the back of the queue with a lot of men in front of me before I get any kind of a cabinet role. That'd be for sure. Join the queue.
I don't know. What line of business are you in, or what line of work are you in, do you mind me asking?
No, I don't mind. I'm an auctioneer here in Dundalk in an independent family business. So it's great. We sort of, an independent business, you can get on with your thing and paddle your own canoe, as they say. But like even in my business, I've pushed for gender balance in the property industry, was successful in recent years in getting representation because there are much more women working in property now than there have been in previous years. So that has evolved a lot. And I think in other industries, we're seeing more and more female principals. In the property industry, for example, our regulator is a woman. So change comes, but it's just not coming everywhere.
And traditionally you would have thought of auctioneering as a fairly male business as well. But as you say, no longer.
Joanne,
will you hang on a second? I've got Graham on the other line there. Graham, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon.
Yeah, you were listening to Joanne there.
I was, yeah, and I'm just a little bit confused as to why she thinks that the gender balance isn't right. The leaders of the parties make the decisions based on who's best capable of doing the job.
They make decisions based on a number of things. One is competence, but others are gender, we're told, and geography.
And geography, yeah.
Well, there's two sides to that. If you think about it, there's three parties in the Dáil who are run by females. Three parties, actually, that are run by females. Now, if Joanne has a wants to vote for somebody, for a female to get into power, well, then vote for them.
But actually, if you look at those three parties, you're talking about the Social Democrats, Labour and Sinn Féin, they have a significantly better female representation than Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. Fianna Fáil, in particular, Fianna Fáil have long now had a serious issue with this. They have 48 TDs, I think seven or eight. I'm not sure, I don't have it in front of me now, but I think about seven of them came back as women. Whereas the Social Democrats and Labour are much closer to the 50-50 mark.
And with respect, Graeme, I did vote for women because, as I said earlier, my constituency went from having one elected TD to three elected TDs last year. So, yeah, a lot of people in this area did, and we increased female representation from one out of five to three out of five, which is massive. It was a great day when we got that result. But to what end?
Oh, sorry, Graeme, I should have let you talk there. Keep going.
No, that's okay. No. And don't get me wrong. I'm not being chauvinistic about this. It's just, I actually voted for Catherine Martin in the Green Party, not the last election, but the one before that. So I have no problem with women being in power, absolutely none. But you have to respect the fact that the leaders of the parties vote people in who are actually the best capable of doing the jobs. And I think the gender balance thing is probably a little bit of a sort of a sideline, in the sense that I don't really know what way to put it, but I'm sure there is very capable of females in Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, but the ministers have voted were put in the jobs because they're best capable to do the job. And now if it just happens that a female is put into the job, that's fine. I have no problem with that.
And if I may respond to that, I suppose to name the elephant in the room, what you're talking about is tokenism, or women being giving token jobs just because they're women, okay? So that's not what it's about. But if I may challenge you on one thing, clearly it's not always about the best person in the room being capable for the job, and this is going to sound controversial, but when you see the solution that the government had to getting the majority, they gave key jobs to satisfy the politics of the matter to get their majority. And that's, I'm talking about the independents there.
Absolutely.
That was a very different situation. So if they had to square the circle, that politics squared the circle there, where was the rest of it? Where was the other squaring the circle with satisfying how many women in this country are women versus men and how are they represented at the cabinet table?
Well, the other question that I ask you then is that would you put a woman into a job who isn't capable of actually doing it?
No, but then none of those TDs are capable.
Are you saying that
some of the TDs women aren't capable?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying if they were more capable and they were worthy of getting the job, I'm sure they would have been given it.
Do you think,
well,
Graeme,
agree with you that they would have been, because they weren't, and test them, give them cabinet positions and let them prove themselves, but we're not even getting to that.
There is an old saying, Graeme, God give me the confidence of a mediocre man. and I'm not suggesting you're mediocre, but I am wondering, do you really think that it is a meritocracy politics, that the best people for the job always gets the job? Do you think that is how those decisions are made?
Well, why else would you put it? Well, okay, the independents are different. I accept that. They've probably been given a couple of favours along the line. But I don't believe that that they've put just males in for the sake of just putting a male in a job. They've actually given the job to the person who's best capable of doing it.
Or the person who brought a running mate in with them, or the person who is in the part of the country that has no senior minister, so they have to put in a junior minister. There's a lot of reasons why political baubles get divvied out, Graeme, I think.
I'm sure there is, yeah. I'm not sure what goes on behind the scenes in cabinet meetings or the political meetings. I've no idea what goes on there. But I don't believe that it's a problem with the gender balance. I believe that the jobs are given out to the people who are best capable of doing them.
But do you think...
Helen McAtee was a fantastic Justice Minister. Very, very capable.
Do you think that it makes a difference, as you say there, and actually Joanne mentioned as well, that the focus that Helen McEntee put on dealing with and putting new legislation in place and putting funding in place for domestic violence and gender-based violence and all of that. Like, do you think that it does matter in policy terms if a woman gets to the top table?
Not necessarily, no, because they all have advisors, and I'm sure the advisors are also gender balanced as well. So they're not going to make a decision that is based purely upon their own belief or their own decision. That they'll make a decision based on what advice that they're given, and I'm sure that the advisors are both female and male, and you know they would also have a reason for giving that advice. And it's up to the minister then to either accept that advice or not.
Okay, well, that's a good point, actually, because I was just going to say there are a lot of women in the background of politics, and actually one of the most experienced people in politics in this country is one of the senior advisors to government, Deirdre Galán, who is a very powerful woman in the background of this government and past governments. Joanne, sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's a little bit, if I may say, Graeme, as though it's the yes minister thing where the advisors are wagging the tail of the dog. I mean, you know, you've got to assume that any minister who's been elected by the people, or sorry, any TD that's elected by the people, is going forward and putting forward policy and legislation with the strength of their conviction. And that is the example that we gave there was Helen McEntee and the legislation that she brought in before. You know, you try to fix things that you can see from your own experience and from your constituent experiences is broken or is in need of attention. And the perspective of what women can see is not being represented. It's not getting out there because it's not at the cabinet table. That's the point. We deal with things that we have an appreciation of, and that's not getting to the table to be discussed and considered and parsed and then assessed by the assessors and the advisors as to whether or not it's robust enough to go forward.
But do they have to be ministers or have a senior role at the cabinet table?
Oh, of course they do. Of course. You know, your cabinet role is the key role here. Backbenchers and TDs who are not at the cabinet table, they do not have the same sway, they do not have the same voice, they do not have the same level of support behind them to bring forward policy and legislative change. It's a structure that's there. That's why it's such a big deal that the optics of that picture, but also why, for example, you and I agreed that the geography of those appointments was so important and the politics of it in relation to the independence, all those things are so important. The key thing is that you're at the table. If you're not at the table, you're only hoping to grab somebody's attention and grab their sleeve when they come out of the big meeting room, you know? It is key.
Okay. Joanne, hang on there, and Graeme, hang on. And we've more calls coming on this. We'll take a break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And you're welcome back. And I want to bring in Mary now. Mary, good afternoon.
Hello, Katie. I'm delighted to speak to you. And I love your upfront programme, Never Misses. And hello to your listeners. Thank you for having me on.
Now, Mary, you have a bit of political experience yourself.
Yes, I was an ex-councillor a long time ago, Katie. And I believe common sense is the greatest quality anybody can have. And that lady from County Loud, tell her if she's still on the line that she is a TD in the making. She's a great, great lady. I thought the wisdom of everything she said to you was just everything that I would have thought of myself.
When you were in the council, as you say now, it's not today or yesterday, Mary.
No, it's not.
You were a Fianna Fáil councillor, were you?
Was, and I worked hand in hand with all the councillors. I didn't believe in playing politics. I used to canvass with a Fine Gael lady, and I hope she's well and listening, and that was years and years ago, and we worked for all of the people.
And was there was it hard for women in politics at that stage?
you look at women, Katie, in the home, and for 9 out of 10 women are running the budgets and everything in the home. They're wonderful. And I'm not anti-men. There's a lot of good, very good men. And I think women has an approach that's fresh. And they should definitely be better. Their gender is wrong. The gender inequality is wrong. And a lot of capable women there. And women as well, I say, Katie, should vote for women that they're, if they're capable, and make sure that they get the get in to represent all of the people for them. And we all have a duty to do that as well.
Do you think that women went
to... the people that... Can you hear me?
I can. Go on, Mary.
Really, all the people that are suffering now, I had it myself at a hospital bed, and only for a kind neighbour when the lights went out, and for my son and my daughter, I don't know where it had been, and the kind neighbour let them plug in a lead for to get the bed working. And I feel so sorry for all the people in Ireland that are still without power, and the people with disabilities and everything else. It is time everybody that were listened to, and lessons were learned. A lot of lessons, Katie.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Do you think women do politics different, Mary?
I do. I think they have the ordinary common sense approach to it, because they have to survive in the world today. They have to, you have to be, common sense is the biggest degree, I think, and listen to people. Yeah. An awful lot of people need a listening ear.
That's for sure.
And that's what we should be doing. And there's an awful lot of people need to be listened to in this world. And but there is a lot of good in it too, Katie. And we've seen that by all the voluntary people and communities, left, right and centre, that have opened their premises, GAA and rugby and everything else, and soccer and all the different organisations, and that have come to see how what they can do for you. We still have a good society out there.
We have, Mary. We should remember that as well. Mary, thank you so much, and thanks for calling in. Great to talk to you. That was Mary Cunningham there in County Monaghan. Martin, good afternoon.
Hiya, Katie. How you doing?
Yeah, Martin, you've been listening to our chat here. Where are you coming at it from?
Yeah, I was listening to the conversation about women in politics and gender politics, and I agree that the balance across all parties should be more equal and we should have more women in politics. But I think we're missing one of the key issues in the 21st century and Irish politics, especially after the last election, which is the question of nepotism. Right across the parties, you know, why we have so many families from all over Ireland who are, you know, uncles, daughters, sons, nephews, whatever, who the family name is what's carrying the politics on. And I understand the idea of name recognition for political parties, but it just seems in a lot of cases, whether it's co-opting on the council seats or the Shannon or whatever, that the whole issue of nepotism has never been addressed in Irish politics. And I think it's something we need to look at.
Do you know, it just occurs to me, though, if you go back over the last 20 or 30 years, if some of the women in politics that did actually make it into politics and make it through the system, if they hadn't a father or a brother or an uncle or, you know, a husband that whose seat they actually went for, we would have had even fewer women in politics, because a huge number of the women who came into politics came in through that route.
But that's not the issue, Katie, that I'm addressing. It's the issue across the board, not just women coming into politics through nepotism, but, you know, family members, whether they're sons or daughters. I mean, you know, and I know, we only have to look at the names in the Dáil to recognise, you know, family dynasties. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, whatever happened to merit in the 21st century, whatever happened to, you know, people coming through a system where their name is as good as someone else's, where they get a chance to go forward. I think it's a serious issue, you know, whether it's male or female, Katie, across the board with all political parties. And it's something we really need to have a social conversation about in Ireland.
Yeah, well, it is for sure a very big part of Irish politics, as you say, right across the board, I think in local and in national politics. Martin, thank you for that. I have lots and lots of calls coming in. Can I bring in Róisín now? Róisín, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. Good afternoon.
So what do you think is the biggest difficulty that women have getting into politics?
I mean, there's all the issues that your previous callers have identified, and the fact that it's just not a wonderful environment for women to operate in, and doll sitting late and all of those things. But before we even get to that level, I think the biggest problem, particularly in the two main parties, is the whole gatekeeper situation, where you have lots of very talented women operating as local activists. They decide to run for local council, and then they step up to compete on the national stage. And it's just very, very difficult to get through the selection process, because invariably the people who are making those decisions are long established, generally male members of the two main parties. And it's a very, very, it's a secretive process largely, and it's a very difficult process to get through. And then even if you do manage to get your name on the ticket, and obviously there's pressure on them these days because of the quota system to put women on, a lot of these women just don't get the support then. They're first-time candidates, and, you know, it requires mentoring, it requires support, and they're not getting that.
You sound like you know what you're talking about there, Róisín. Have you gone down this road yourself, or are you familiar
with
it?
No, I just happened to study it. I went back to college during COVID and did a master's in this whole area of gender representation in Ireland. And, you know, honestly, we show up so badly. I think we're, at the moment, we rank 20th out of the 27 European members for female representation. It's just shocking. It's really, really poor.
And you say that, and I do think, because people maybe are not familiar with the system, the whole selection process and the selection convention, and obviously this goes to a vote of members, and it's a one-man, one-vote situation, and it's usually, in many cases, it is one man,
yeah.
One vote rather than one woman, one vote. But, of course, the problem is that you have to, in order to get there, you have to elbow the men aside, basically. And some of these men have been nursing their seat there as well on the council for maybe a decade. And their time, they see their time finally, maybe the big beast in the constituency is retiring, and they finally see their time has arrived. And then suddenly this woman rocks up. So you
but
can see why
that might have been, yeah, that woman might have been beavering away for years on local issues and establishing her credentials and her capabilities. I think there's just a lack of commitment amongst the two major parties in particular, and I'm singling them out because they have performed really, really poorly. I think they've paid token attention to the quotas. If you compare what they've done with some of the smaller parties, but probably particularly the Social Democrats really stand out as being very pro-female. And also, I don't have the data for the most recent election, but in the last general election, their success rate of actually bringing women through and actually getting them elected is phenomenal. It's more than twice what the bigger parties achieved. And that's because they put the support in behind them and they gave them the mentoring. And they were really pulled through. Whereas I really, really feel that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil have not embraced this idea at all. And
but is the difficulty, going back to exactly what you're saying there, that because people have to come through selection conventions, now we know as well the selection conventions, people can be added to tickets, and that's obviously what happened in a lot of cases in this election. Women were added very late in the day, without much of a chance to really make a good run at it. But that in the selection convention where you know, people are put on tickets through votes of the membership, that there just isn't enough women at that level in the common to actually, you know, support other women and push them through.
Yeah, but I think that's coming from the top down. You know, there has to be leadership on that issue. And it's up to the leaders of those two parties in particular to get that message through to the party that we need our politicians to be more representative of the population as a whole. And, you know, it carries all the way through, because even for the women who do get elected, like, say, if you look at the Doyle committees and women's representation on the Doyle committees, which are, you know, kind of a fairly critical element of the political system, and they're not getting seats on these committees, and they're certainly not sharing them.
But if there's only 25% of the Doyle are female, you kind of do, and, you know, as you say, every party has a certain number of seats on each committee. You can see how you run out of road there very fast.
Yeah, but you they're not even getting 25% representation on Doyle committees. So it's at every single level. I just feel the barriers are in place, and it can be done. I mean, the Scandinavian countries have over 40% representation. There isn't a bias against female. I mean, all the European studies show there is no bias against female politicians in general in populations throughout Europe. The problem is, in Ireland, we don't have the will from the two major parties to actually allow this to happen. And it's disgraceful. It's 2025. Let's go, guys.
Okay, Roisin, thank you for that. More callers coming in. Claire, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you?
Am I right that you're not in favour, you wouldn't be in favour of gender quotas?
No, I think that, I do believe in a gender balance, but I think a quota is a target, and a target is there to be met. I think that people should be provided with positions based on their expertise and their skills. There definitely should be a gender balance, but I don't believe that, you know, ticking a box in terms of a quota is a useful way to do that.
But how, like, we've tried it without the quotas for a very long time, and we were getting nowhere, really. How do you then move the dial?
I think, moving the dial means, we have all the conversations, we have all the commitments towards kind of gender balance, where they say, we're committed to change, but real change happens from action. Unless we see the action, and unless the action happens faster, we're just going to be in the same situation that we are 10 years down the line.
But what's the action? Like, how are we going to force this? Like, who do we turn to? Who are we asking to take action here?
I mean, we're turning to, I mean, it's everybody in a sense, you know, in terms of education and awareness. Being such a proactive country, you know, we have, we're a country that has had two female presidents. We have seen it. It can happen. What we need to do is within our schools, within our education system, in society as a whole, show young girls and women that these positions, in terms of being a woman in business, being a woman in politics, is something that they should be involved in. And again, it's more kind of society as well. There's a lot of things that put people off and put women off around going into politics. In terms of, you know, so there should be a lot more kind of support for women moving forward under these types of positions, I think.
Okay, Claire, good one. Thank you for that. Philip, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Where are you coming from on this?
Well, I think it's probably more of an issue of time available to women, and I think a lot of it's to do with our school time.
Oh, we have...
Off of school, the kids have... Sorry,
the line just dropped for a second there, Philip, with you. You're saying it's about the school timetable, is it?
Yeah, well, the school timetable requires, basically, you need after-school care for kids, and when, particularly in a man and a woman situation, if somebody somewhere has to sacrifice the time to either, you know, pick kids up from school, drop them off, or sort out after-school care. Whereas if the primary school system in particular, even the school system, the broader one, had less summer holiday, less requirement for after-school care. So in other words, just aligned with the working day. So kids went to school from 8:30, 9 in the morning until 5 in the evening. And you could spread out the school curriculum. You could include more PE. Basically use your school infrastructure much better for education and child time during the day.
Would it not be a better idea, Philip, if more men took responsibility for the school pick-up time and the and you know those sort of issues, rather than trying to turn our schools into some kind of child-minding afternoon service?
That's possible, but the school system. If basically what everybody's talking about is that women need more support. If you're kind of looking at where's the limitation in the day, your kids, they're only catered for half of the day, and then you have to go and get a secondary aftercare for the other half. I know, it's probably not a solution that everybody thinks. It was just something, particularly with myself and my wife, that we're kind of, when we look at our options, because both of us want to pursue our careers. It's not a one or the other. Both people want to fulfill, their, contribution to society. And so if your school day is aligned with your working day and your kids are getting a much better, much more wholesome school experience with all their peers at the same time, well, by freeing up time, you're naturally going to allow both genders to succeed, and you're always going to then get the best out of both genders. One's not going to be held back because of time constraints.
Okay. Thanks for that, Philip. I want to bring in Catherine Bulbulia. Catherine.
Hello, Katie.
How are you?
Hello. I'm very well indeed, and I'm listening with rapt attention to this discussion.
I bet you are. And in case there's anyone out there, because you had such an unusual name, I'm sure it'll ring so many bells with people. You were, of course, a councillor and a senator.
Yes.
How long are you out of politics now, Catherine?
Oh, quite some time, Katie. Let's not go down that road.
Okay.
But I was first elected to Waterford County Council in 1979 and was the first woman ever elected in the history of the state to that particular body.
In 1979. Wow.
Indeed. And to my amazement, I headed the poll in my electoral area. And then my troubles began because I assumed that it would be a bit like school, where if you did well in an exam, you got patted on the head and told what a great girl you were. But in actual fact, heading the poll can be an absolute handicap because all my colleagues, who were men, of course, looked at me with amazement. And for those men who had ambition, I was seen as a threat. And really, the name of the game was to suppress me in every possible way, while being superficially pleasant and friendly. It was most unpleasant, actually, in reality.
I think,
and the worst bit was that it came from my own party.
Well, I was just going to say that is very traditional, Catherine.
I know.
In politics, it's never the lad from the other party that you need to watch. It's the one inside the tent that you need to keep an eye on always.
That's true, but nobody told me that. And I had great women who backed me and supported me, and I was in the Women's Political Association. And people like the late Gemma Hussey, Mavis Arnold, and others, Hilary Pratt, backed me to the hilt.
Kit O'Hearn would have been in the Senate that time, wouldn't she?
This was the local authority. I didn't know anybody in the Senate in those days. But just to say, I was an innocent abroad, really, when it came to those things. And I had to learn it the hard way.
And what was it like being a woman with, in such a male world at that stage? And how important was it to have other women there to turn to?
Well, I think it would have been important, and it would have been really of great comfort, but it just wasn't the case. I mean, the first 5 years term of office. I was on my own. And I just learned so much, rather open-mouthed and amazed at what went on. For example, there was putting the people on various committees, and that was fine. And there was a committee called the Sheep Dipping Committee. Okay. And I, of course, didn't put my hand up because I knew nothing about sheep or dipping or anything about it. And there was a surge of interest in it. And I wondered and wondered why this was so. And eventually somebody was picked. And this was all about travelling expenses, because the Sheep Dipping Committee meetings took place a long way from Dungarvan, where Waterford County Council was based. And I mean, that was, to me, quite, you know, intriguing. I would make the point that in those days, councillors did not receive any salary at all. The most you got was your travel expenses to the meeting. And that for women was a handicap, I would think, going into politics. And happily, that day has ended, and people think it's fitting, as it is, that there should be remuneration.
Absolutely, because it's a huge amount of work, local politics now.
Yes.
Did you, like, in terms of how you approached, like, this is the point that we're trying to get to here. Like, what difference does it actually make whether or not your local representative is female, or then move on up the line, and whether it's a woman making the decision in the Department of Health or in the Department of Justice or whatever? What actual difference does it make to the rest of us?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, you have perhaps different feelings about things and you see things from a certain perspective or angle. Just let me give you an example. In the early 1980s, when I was on the county council, there were wives being maltreated by their spouses. There was what we now know as coercive control and difficulty. And there were women who needed to separate from their husbands. Now, there was no divorce, and separation even was frowned upon. And I remember going to the then county manager, a really very nice man, and explaining to him that there was this particular woman who, if she didn't get separate housing from her spouse, was in real danger, as were her children. And I was listened to very sympathetically, I must say that. This was a very nice and a good man. But he said, for example, his hands were tied, that if he began to consider separate housing for somebody in that position, he would be sort of knocked down in the rush for similar decisions. He was the one who made the decision. So maybe I have strayed off the point a bit, but I'm just saying now that quite a lot of our demand and need for additional housing is based on the separation of people in marriage, and more houses are required. But I do think that women can make cases well and sympathetically for people, and have a particular outlook and slant on life. They are different. We are different. We're complementary, but we're different. And I think we can argue the case, and we can, if there is a woman at the other end of the argument, we can perhaps be more convincing.
Well said, Catherine. Thank you so much. Lovely to hear from you again.
That's nice, Katie. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we're going to move on now, because we're still getting calls in from people who have been massively impacted by that storm. We're on day 7 now. Day 7, and imagine people are still without power. Geraldine, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Geraldine, you're down in Clare.
That's right.
And yep. You're still in the dark, are you?
Yes, still in the dark. Lots of candles and a transistor radio, which makes life actually bearable. And I have two dogs, and so I'm out of the house during the day. But every night when I get into bed, Katie, the bed seems to be colder. And I have one of those lovely long hot water bottles, so that comes with me. And one of the dogs drapes herself over my feet on top of the two duvets and the furry wrap Anise gave me a few years ago. But there is a bit more light in the evenings now, but going home to candlelight at, you know, 5:30 or 6 makes for a long night. And because of various bits and pieces that have happened to my body, it doesn't react well to cold. Yeah. So I'm in a bit of pain as well.
Right. When are you hearing it's coming back, Geraldine?
Well, I last spoke to the ESB, I think it was actually last Saturday or maybe Monday, and I was told the 4th of February.
Right, so we're going into next week then.
Yes, but there are people considerably worse off than me, for one thing. And there are pockets around now where I see lights on in the evening. So I think what they're doing is doing as best as they can to put some sort of order on it. I think some power was restored locally the day before yesterday so that the primary school could open. Mm-hmm. Things like that. So that seems sensible.
Yeah. Geraldine, will
but, you... by 8:30 or 9 in the evening, I no longer feel heroic.
Right, exactly. You're thinking of other people until the cold starts to get into the bones. Geraldine, will you hang on there? Because I want to bring in Mari down. She's in the West as well. And you're talking about some people and you know that are in a worse situation than you. And Mari is familiar with that. Mari, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I know you're worried about elderly people, frail people. Who are out there depending on electricity to keep themselves well?
Yeah, I couldn't understand how when Micheál Martin was in Roscommon on Monday or Tuesday, I can't remember which day I saw the footage, how no one brought to his attention the number of elderly that are being cared for in the home that are on electric mattresses that are, you know, they're pressure relieving. They stop people from getting pressure sores. And if they can't get power, those mattresses can only hold air for like 48 hours. And after that, then those people will get pressure sores. Like there's no other way around it. And the only option they have is to go to hospital. Then you have all the people that are on like portable oxygen concentrators. They're all electronically controlled. Nebulizers are all plug in, all to do with breathing. Those people are so susceptible to infections, whatnot. They're all going to be hospital admissions. And it's just, I don't think enough gravity has been given to it. You know, that people don't seem to realise, like, you know, Micheál Martin was like, oh, the power will be back. But, like, that's no good if someone's gotten a pressure sore. They're on the way to hospital. It's the peak of flu season. I just think in the next 2 weeks it's going to tell a tale in the west of Ireland, most definitely.
And I should say, of course, you work for the HSE, so
yeah,
you're taking calls from people who are desperate for...
Of
some
course,
help
and
this.
Like all we can supply are like synthetic mattress toppers, you know, to relieve pressure. But they're not a long-term solution. They're definitely not for 6 or 7 days use, you know, for someone that is susceptible to pressure sores.
And I think I know, but you know, yeah. Mari, I was just going to say, I think if you're not familiar with this situation, if you're not having cared for somebody a pressure sore is a really, really serious thing.
It's a huge health risk. Yeah. It's a huge health risk. You know, and like people say it's a humanitarian crisis and people laughing it off, it is down here because these people have nowhere else to go. They can't be moved to a hotel. They can't. Their medical needs are too complex. The only place they can go to is a hospital. And I just feel that the bed crisis that there is already, it's just going to be hugely exacerbated. And I just hate to think what things are going to be like in a couple of weeks' time.
There was another story there, I think it was yesterday, about an elderly person who's been bedbound because they need an electric hoist just to get up.
Exactly. see, that's the other side of it, you know, and they are at huge risk of pressure source because they can't be moved. But if their alternating mattress isn't alternating, you know, it's just, it's so awful what's happening. And I just, yeah, it's very, very difficult for people. Carers need, I don't know what we can put in place for them going forward, but if a storm of that magnitude was to hit again next week, and storm season will continue up to April, like that's the simple logistics of it. So if this happens again in 3 or 4 weeks' time, what are we going to do?
I'm conscious of all these people as well, not being able to move around, and the cold, just the environment they're now in. That must be for carers and for the people, you know, family carers.
For carers, meals on wheels, everything. People can't get in. Also, the fact that the phones went down was huge. You know, people in medical emergencies been told to ring 999. No mobiles worked. Yeah. Like, all masks were down. There was zero mobile phone coverage. Telling us to log on to get, like, access to where hubs were. That wasn't a possibility. You know, it beggars belief. It honestly does. We are so reliant on electricity in this country.
Yeah, it's
and I don't know what's going to happen.
It's been such a wake-up call, I think. And the people who are contacting you, some of them must be very close to the end of their tether, like, so worried about
they're so upset. And, but, like, yeah, like, they're just... I'm like, what can we say? You know, if it's a medical emergency, you go to your A&E. That's all, you know, and I worry about the state of the A&Es in this area over the next few weeks because there are going to be no beds left. They can't discharge patients home because there's no power in them. You know, so the patients that are well enough to come home in hospital at present can't be discharged because we can't put the facilities in place.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very difficult situation, as Geraldine said there. You know, she is dealing with her own stuff there, but there's a lot of people out there in a very, very bad situation. Mary, thank you for that. It's really very important to highlight that of what's going on and understand what some families are dealing with this week. Laura, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you?
You're in Sligo, is it, Laura?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
So, you have 4 children?
I have, yeah.
What are their ages, Laura?
They're 8, 7, 5 and 3.
And you're all freezing.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's crisis stage now. We're 7 days into it. Our electricity went out last Friday at 3 a.m. and nothing since.
How are the kids doing?
The kids are, they were very sick last week. We're on for chest infections, croup. They're on inhalers, steroids, antibiotics. So it was probably one of the worst weeks for this to hit. My 5-year-old boy, he has asthma. So at the minute, he's on medicine every 4 hours for his chest. And the older lad, he is on regular inhalers as well. His chest infection still hasn't fully cleared. They're 4, kids are kids and they're very happy and they're probably in better form than me and their father, you know. It's just, it can turn into a bit of a downer come 5 p.m, you know.
And have you a means to heat the house at all? Like, how are you managing?
We have a wee stove in the kitchen and we've that lit first thing in the morning. And throughout the rest of the house and the bedrooms, there isn't an ounce of heat. And at this stage, you'd nearly breathe and you'll see the vapour in the air. You know, it's that cold in the bedrooms. The kids are going to bed now at night, obviously earlier, because, you know, we're in darkness at 5 o'clock. The candles are lit and the LED light. And they're wearing 2 pairs of pyjamas. And whatever fleece blankets we have in the house, we're throwing it over them to try and keep them warm and to prevent further sickness and hopefully no pneumonia or anything, because our last update from the ESB was yesterday evening and we thought we were getting it back and was put off. The following day, this was continuous since last Saturday. And the latest update now is it's February 5th. It's just appalling. Like.
Yeah.
You know.
And are you, I mean, how are you keeping your spirits up, Laura? How are you keeping going?
With 4 children around you, you know, you have no time to think of anything. It's nearly when you're talking about it that it's hard. It's getting hard now, You know, it was a novelty last Friday, the board games out, novelty for the weekend as such. But when the cold is setting into your house and you don't want to leave the one room where there's heat, it's just, it can get you down, like. It can get you down.
Can you cook? Are you able to cook there?
We have one, we have a gas hob. We're able to cook the pasta and the soup.
Okay.
That's what it's been going on for the last week, yeah. Yeah, we have a cooler box. We have no fridge or freezer. Obviously, all our food went off come Friday. There was €200 worth of food in the fridge. And our freezer, we have a large chest freezer, larger, 5 or 6 shelves in it. And all that food thawed out, obviously. So that all had to be dumped. So at the minute, the only perishable food we have in the house, it's not even in the house. It's in a little cooler box outside with cubes of ice. It's a 2 litre of milk.
Right. Do you at least have a dog to keep you warm, like Geraldine?
We do. And we're worried about the dog because he's 12 years of age and we're hoping he won't get the hypothermia. He's in beside the stove every night when we go to bed.
I'd be bringing that dog to bed with me now if I were you, Laura.
It's warmer where he is than where we're going to bed every night.
I don't know what to say to you. I mean, it's very unfortunate. The kids had just, because so many kids were on antibiotics and all sorts of stuff in the last couple of weeks because there was so much stuff going around. It's just, it's what you absolutely don't need when you know, you're trying to get them back up and running.
Yeah, back up to full health. Yeah, and you know, they're not getting the nourishment either because we've no proper facilities.
Yeah.
And there's an awful lot of people worse off. We all know that, myself and my husband. But it's just, for such a big family, it's hard to keep everything going and keep the momentum up for another week from what we know. We don't know. Will it be restored in a week?
It's the uncertainty is the killer. That's what we've been hearing from people all week. If you knew, you could plan your way up to it and kind of deal
with
it.
You could. You could try and accommodate, but we don't believe anything anymore. And actually, this morning I was talking to a lady and she has 2 young kids. She had a beautiful 2-month-old baby and a 3-year-old boy. And they're in one room in the house with the fire lit and they have a generator. They're lucky in one sense, but no one's lucky that has their ESB out at this stage. And they're able to boil water for the baby's bottle. But she was told yesterday evening via the ESB app that their electricity, they've got no date. It's unforeseeable.
Oh, that's the one. You definitely don't want to get that message.
I don't want to see that one. Yeah. No, but it's unforeseeable. Yeah, it's crazy back here. No one would believe it.
Laura, the very best of luck. The very best of luck there. I'm going to have to take my last break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And I want to bring in Joy now. Joy, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And congratulations, Joy. I believe you're a newly elected councillor since the summer.
That's correct. I was elected to the Donegal County Council in June last year, it'll be now.
Yeah. And do you think that makes, because it's actually, there isn't a lot of women in Donegal County Council, is there?
No, I know there's about 26% of councillors in Ireland are women. That figure's already far too low. But here in Donegal, that number is just 8.1%. We only have 3 female councillors in the council, you know, out of the 37 elected councillors in there. So that is far too low. You know, I think politics has been a male-dominated arena, but women bring a powerful voice. They bring empathy and a unique perspective. You know, and I think that's essential in addressing the complex issues that councillors have to address. You know, so I don't think it's representative of our citizens, if you know what I mean, when there's only 3 lady councillors.
It's very poor, in fairness. A very poor representation number. Listen, I wanted to talk to you about that, but we've only a minute to go, and I've just realised you're in a mobile home at the moment?
Yes, sadly. I'm affected by the defective concrete block crisis here in Donegal and beyond, but this is the epicentre of this crisis. So basically I've gone from a victim to a campaigner for 100% redress now to a politician. So it's been a three-step prong approach for me.
And were you affected by the storm?
The storm was very severe here up in Donegal, I have to say. Now, but we did seek refuge in a hotel on that night because it was just too unsafe to be in a mobile home in the middle of a red weather warning, you know. Yeah. These homes are structurally unsound now, and there was a lot of damage caused to an awful lot of properties, making them even more dangerous to be living in, you know. But in a mobile home, it wouldn't have been suitable for anyone to ride out that storm in a red weather warning.
No, not for sure. We're out of time. No. Joy, thanks for getting in touch. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you.
That is all we have time for today. On sound, we had Tommy O'Sullivan. Our broadcast coordinator was Shane Galvin. The programme was produced by Shan O'Gorman. And stand by now for Ray.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Home in on end-of-season savings on bedding, curtains, wallpapers and more. In-store and online at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.